Today we're talking about how to go from zero to one in five steps. We have with us our expert, Pablo Shrugo, who is a partner at Mistral. There he focuses on venture capital investments in seed stage companies. He's also the founder and host of the Product Market Fit Show, and previously was the founder of Gymtrack, which was venture-backed, but unfortunately went bust. Hope you enjoy the show. He's the founder of Gymtrack, which was venture-backed, but unfortunately went bust. So Pablo, you want to talk about how to get to from zero to one. What does that actually mean in practice? Like, what counts as zero? And when do you get to one, which is now the different stage we're going to start scaling? Like, what do you think that journey is, and where should people be paying attention to it?
It's a great question. So, like, I mean, zero is like the starting is probably the most understood place, right? That is anything from, like, you know, even that actually has some subtleties to it. I think the way I think about zero is honestly, like, depending on how it happens, it could be pre-idea or at idea, right? I mean, there's a few different ways to come up with a startup idea. Sometimes it's kind of by happenstance, it's almost by accident, in which case that's effectively your zero, is when you kind of have this aha-like type of moment or something that pulls you in a certain direction and you start exploring it. And then there are others who are, you know, actively trying to come up with a startup. And so that's really your zero. The way I think about one is similar to the way I think about product market fit. And, you know, product market fit is fundamentally a spectrum, right? I mean, there is no, itself isn't a zero or one. It's not black and white. It's kind of shades of gray. But I would argue that there's effectively a line that at one point you cross and you have product market fit. And then you can, you have to continually improve the level of product market fit. You have to continually adapt to market changes and competitive dynamic changes to make sure you continue to have product market fit. And as you launch new features, every feature has product market fit. But nonetheless, like, that's really the zero to one. So zero is kind of like idea or even pre-idea. And one is where you can honestly say to yourself in front of a mirror, you know what, like, we have product market fit.
I think the product market fit area is so interesting because when I talk to more experienced entrepreneurs, they kind of know that point when they look in hindsight. But often you see entrepreneurs who haven't really actually hit product market fit yet, who are convinced that they have. And how do you know that level? So you're obviously looking at it from an investor perspective. What kind of things do you need to see to be like, yeah, they've got product market fit now from the outside?
It's a fascinating question with you know, kind of no clear answer. Like, that's the fundamental reality. It's one of those things, you know it when you see it and you feel it when it's there, I think, as a founder. But I've spoken with many founders who thought they had product market fit only to realize they didn't. And then when they really got it, they're like, okay, this is what it really feels like. And so there's no clear answer, but I could tell you this, like, along the way to product market fit, one of the most important pieces is effectively, you know, value delivery. Like, that's really kind of one of the things that's an intermediate step, right? Between idea and product market fit, you have value delivery. And so that's a critical piece of how much value are you really delivering, right? Are you solving kind of top of mind problems for your customers? So those are the sort of questions. And there's many different signals, many different things you can tune into to kind of understand that. Product market fit is when, you know, the classic definition is where you feel like market demand, market pull is not the primary problem for your organization. That doesn't mean that you don't need to invest in sales. You don't need to invest in marketing. Of course you do. Like, you know, the Facebooks and the Instagrams that just kind of grow 100% organically are, you know, one in a billion or whatever. And yet there's a lot of the companies that have true product market fit. But nonetheless, like, as a founder, it's not so much like, how am I going to grow next quarter, next year? It's more, how am I going to make sure that the rest of my organization is set up properly so that whatever growth comes doesn't blow us up, you know, and we're not almost like, you know, then ultimately you have churn problems because not because demand wasn't there, but because you couldn't actually service the demand. That's when you have true product market fit. And another key ingredient to true product market fit is that you actually know what's driving your growth and how to drive your growth. And this is, you know, a classic problem, which is when you kind of delude yourself, let's say, into thinking you have product market fit because you've hit some magic ARR number, which, you know, doesn't exist. And you go out and you raise a round and you hire into that and you actually didn't have product market fit, what you'll find is you've created an organization with probably 2x the employees, 2x the expenses, but not 2x the growth. So that's how you know you kind of, you don't have it. Again, we're never going to get to a perfect definition, but happy to continue exploring it because it really is kind of the devil's in the details. It's a very nuanced, it's a nuanced concept.
And like, I know you recently gave a talk about the 5 steps people can take to find product market fit. What's the first step of that? What's the first thing people should be doing?
So the first step, I mean, one of the first books that I read that I'm sure like every listener here has read or at least heard of is like The Lean Startup, right? By Eric Ries. And, you know, the big concept to come out of that is the MVP, the minimum viable product, talks about iteration and optimization, all that stuff. And, but the challenge is that what Eric is talking about is really how to optimize the solution. So once you have a product market, how to kind of iterate quickly so that you can get better and better solution. What I found talking to over 50 founders of late stage companies that are well beyond product market fit, and, you know, on the Product Market Fit Show, which is our podcast, we only talk about 0 to 1. What I found is that before the lean startup, effectively before startup mode, there's research mode. That's how we say it. And so there's a huge research element that is explicit, that lasts months, that is very consistent amongst these, you know, today 100 million ARR businesses, that is not that common amongst most founders that I speak with. And, you know, by way of example, there's a company called Ada in Toronto. They're doing, you know, over 50 million ARR today. And when they started on one product. At one point, the product had some traction, but not enough. They saw something interesting in the customer service, customer support area, and they're a venture-backed business. And the founders decided to spend an entire year, as founders of venture-backed startup, spend an entire year hired as full-time customer service agents for 7 different companies, so they could understand in the most detailed way what it's like to be a customer service agent. They then built software to start automating themselves out of that job. And the output of that is Ada, which is, you know, today an AI base, but back then was just kind of one of those chatbots for customer service. But there were so many chatbots. And guess what? They got it right. And they got it right because they understood the customer so well. So that's the level of research, you know, versus I think most, especially first time founders, I did this myself. You know, I was selling to gyms in my old days at Gymtrack, and we went to 25 gyms and we did quote unquote research, but our research was like, hey, like, do you think this is a cool idea or not? They're like, yeah, sure, it's a cool idea. And you know, who's going to tell you no, right? And you're like, oh, 25 to 25 people said it was a cool idea. Like that's, you know, fake research. And then you have real research. And the reason you need to do that is because that's the way that you find problems worth solving, which is step one.
No, I love that. And I think, as you're saying that as well about the fake research, I do think I talk to many people who do that kind of research, right? And it's one thing if you ask your friends and family, do you think it's a good idea? Some of them are just going to say yes, just to keep you happy. Others are always going to say no because they don't think you can do it. Maybe they don't believe in you. But you're unlikely to get the truth in many ways. You're going to get wherever their biases are about you as opposed to the idea itself. So it's really interesting to see, like, especially when people go to that level of dedication to do that research. And where do you go from there? So you've done the research properly, not the fake way. What happens next?
Just to add one more piece to that, I think one of the key elements of that research is making sure, and this is part of it, is figuring out who your ideal customer profile is, who is your ICP. But once you have a sense of the ICP, that's the only advice. Like what they say matters tremendously, and what others say matters almost not at all. Like sometimes as an investor, people will ask me, hey, like, here's my product, what do you think? And I'm like, listen, I'm not a buyer. Like, frankly, what I think is irrelevant because I'm not your ICP. I can't, you know, what I'm going to say is going to be very surface level, very like broad based. That's not the stuff you're after. You're after the little details that make a product go from good to great, that make you really understand whether you're solving something top of mind. So anyways, that's step one. Step two is around focus and alignment, right? And so the line I like to say here is only the insanely focused survive. There's this book called Only the Paranoid Survive by Andy Grove. And they talk about like big company CEOs have to be paranoid because otherwise they get complacent. But in the early stages, you know, there's nothing to be complacent about because, you know, you're not successful. Like, and so that's not really the main issue. But what I do find is by definition, every single startup's under-resourced. They don't have enough to do everything they want to do, which means the only way you're going to get anything done is if you're truly insanely focused. And I use the word insane because some of the examples that, you know, I spoke with the founder of Wealthsimple, a really popular app in Canada, kind of like a Robinhood, a little bit different. But he told me in the early days, he would call every user within 30 seconds of sign up and give them his personal phone number. And he did this hundreds of times and said, you know, if you need anything, call me, which is insane. Like, I can't really advise a founder to do that. But the point is, those are the insane things that really focused founders do. Because from Mike's perspective, he was like, look, all I care about is that my first few hundred users love our product, right? And tell people about it. And if I do this crazy thing, it's going to help drive the needle on that. And so that's the sort of insane focus that makes sure the entire team, however small it might be, is fully focused on what truly matters, what truly moves the needle, so that you can get to the next step. You know, the other analogy, I like, this is something that I found when I was at Gymtrack. We had so many things to do, so many things. And oftentimes what I would find is, dude, we're crossing off these things and they're not moving us. Like, they're actually not moving us forward. We got a logo done. We got a web page done. We hired a lawyer. Like, we did all these things, and yet I'm no closer to product market fit. And so the way I like to think about it is, your list of 50, 100 to-dos, don't think of them as shades of gray. Think of them as ones and zeros. You've got probably one, two, or three ones that if you don't do them, you will fail. And if you do them, you'll move to the next step. And you've got 50 plus zeros, which frankly don't matter and don't get you any closer to product market fit. And that kind of, you know, black and white thinking is useful because it helps you get insanely focused on the things that really matter.
Yeah, I think there's a problem even I've seen with the things I've done myself is where you have so many ideas because you're all excited, especially being so excited, so enthusiastic. You've got all of these things you want to do. But by doing a lot of things mediocrely, you're not moving the needle, right? It's like, what's, like you said, what are the ones that on this list that people actually care about, that a customer is going to be happy with? And then you can add the bells and the whistles and the other things later on. Like, so many companies have changed their logos later on down the line. It's not as important as sometimes people think. And if you don't have any customers, you might have spent 10 grand on a logo. That's wasted money, right?
That's totally right. And those things change over time, right? So like, you might have, you know, a handful of customers using your product. And on your list, you might get 10 more customers, you know, design a deck, kind of perfect my website. Like, just the list goes on and on. And the reality is, the top thing is make sure your current product, you know, customers love your product. Because if that doesn't happen, you can get 10 more and you're going to have the same problem. Like, those things shift over time, but there's always going to be at any given point, one, two, or three things that if you don't get those done, you just won't make it to the next step. And it's about constantly reminding yourself. And the challenge is that almost always they're the hardest things to solve. And so psychologically, we all love progress and we all love crossing things off of our list. So you will find yourself as a founder, I found myself as a founder, moving towards not the most important things, but the things that could get done easily and quickly so that you could have a day where you feel like progress. But just remember, if you don't get those top things done, you won't get closer to product market fit and you will not survive. Like, that's, you know, that's the reality of startups. So always thinking that way and being insanely focused about the things that move the needle is a critical trait that I've seen amongst founders of what are now unicorns.
What are some of those things that do move the needle for many companies that you've just seen so many founders neglect? And if people listening right now are trying to find product market fit, what are some of those priorities they should have there as well? What should be top of their list?
You know, honestly, if I'm talking about idea stage startups, like closer to the zero than the one, I would argue that 95% of these startups that I've seen fail because fundamentally they're not solving a top of mind problem. That's you know, it reminds me of like Talladega Nights with like Will Ferrell, where he's like a race car driver, right? And he's called like Ricky Bobby. And his line is, if you ain't first, you're last, right? Like, that's what he says at the beginning. And he believes it. And then later on, he finds out, well, actually, you could be second, you could be third. And that's like his big revelation. But in the world of startups, like, if you ain't first, you're last. Like, that's kind of the reality. If you're not solving a top of mind problem, what you're going to hear is next year, next quarter. And so that's something that I see often in the very early stages is that founders are not kind of digging deep enough and not therefore realizing that they're actually not solving a top of mind problem. And that's the reason why everything else, you know, why they can't fundraise, why they can't seem to get new customers, why their price point is so low, why retention might be too high, all these other things that you can try to solve with like a better product, right? With a nicer story, a better deck, a better forecast. And yet you're not getting at the thing, which is fundamentally, if I ask your customers, your five customers, your 10 customers, your 20 customers, your one customer, is this like a number one problem for you? They'd say, no, actually it's not. This is what I worry about every day over here, but you're solving this thing over there. And that's the fundamental like breakpoint.
We mentioned this bit before we started recording as well about how there's people, like, for example, you get a top 100 list, right? And if somebody's really happy about being in the top 100 in their sector, then I have to question, well, shouldn't you want to be number one? Like, isn't that the whole point? You shouldn't be like, I'm really happy in the top 100 companies, because the top 100 companies, a lot of them are going to fail at this any given point, right? It's, well, how are you going to stand out? Because you've got to, I think any entrepreneur has to have that mindset behind them of like, we're going to be the best at what we do. And it might not necessarily be a massive niche, and it might not be that you take on the entire market. But if you're focused on customer service, for example, you're going to be the best possible customer service for utility companies or whatever industry you're going for. But just being, oh, we're really happy with the top 10, eventually somebody else on that list is going to outcompete you and steal your customers.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think you definitely want to win your market, whatever that, you know, however big that market is. And you definitely want to solve a top of mind problem for your ICP, regardless how many of those ICPs there are. But it's almost always easier to go from finding a larger market when you're the most important one for your current small ICPs than it is becoming a top priority when you have a broader market.
Yeah, it's why I like this, the whole idea of like get a small niche, dominate the niche, expand the niche, dominate that niche, and then just keep going that way. And we've got our five steps, right? How far through the steps are we now? What comes next?
So the next step is, I mean, perfect segue, because it's you have to be in the market to win the market, which is effectively exactly what we're talking about. And like that one is, you know, it sounds kind of cool, but like it also is so obvious that it can be meaningless at first blush. But really there's two underlying truths to it. One of them is what you're alluding to, which is almost everything big starts small, and more often than not starts in some kind of a niche that, you know, so small you sometimes can't even call it a market. Like, I mean, even you go way back, like look at Nike, right? Nike started selling running shoes. You know, there was maybe like $100 million worth of like running shoes purchased in a year. Like that was the entire TAM, and people didn't go jogging. Like this was not a mainstream activity at all. So it was only pro running athletes, and there was competition already. Like there was Adidas, there was Puma, there was a lot of big companies. That's the niche they started with, but they had, you know, arguably the best kind of ROI on a shoe, whether it was the best shoe or the best price to value, whatever it was. You know, the Tigers were just really, really good. And then the tailwind happened, but he didn't predict, hey, this market for running is going to be $100 billion market in the future, and then I'm going to go to basketball. Like that's the other piece of this puzzle, is you can't strategize your way to success. So all of those crystal ball activities you're doing in your deck are worth very little to nothing. The reality is the market's either going to pull you into something ever bigger, or it won't, but you have to be in the market to win the market, right? You have to start with something that's solving a top of mind problem for someone. And then, you know, almost hopefully, right, the market will pull you somewhere, or you will find unique insights and find ways to move somewhere, because it's not, you know, you're not just kind of crossing your fingers and hoping. But what you can't do is just think that, you know, if you read enough Gartner reports, you can kind of chart your way from zero to 100 million. And this kind of Som Sam Tam analysis, it's just not real.
That's what I was just about to ask you when you were talking there, because you see so many decks of like the Tam, Sam, and everything like that. And it's like, this is completely irrelevant to what you do. So it's like, we do a little thing here, but our market is the fitness market, and that's worth 100 billion. It's like, well, but that's just what that number is irrelevant to what your company is actually doing. And how do you feel like when people obviously send you decks for investment, how do some people do that well when they're trying to show that they've got a market that is a reasonable size, that is worth investing in, but don't just pluck these numbers that just
think. So I like to keep it really simple. And the back of the envelope that I do is, we just invest in a company that sells software to property managers of short-term rentals. And so the question is for me, okay, if this company wants to get to $100 million in ARR, what would have to be true? And so you kind of invert it, right? And then you say, okay, well, you know, this is the current price point. You'd have to maybe double your ACV, let's say. And then, you know, over time, which like pretty, you know, often happens, your ACV grows as you add more features and whatever. So let's say ACV doubles and it's this much, 10K per year, just as an example. Okay, well, how many customers would you need to have, which is just basic math. Okay, you need to have this many customers to reach 100 million. Okay, how many actual property management companies are there today? And then therefore, what's the implied growth rate of that market and the market share you would have to have? And implied or not, that's kind of the bet that you're making. And that's about the extent to which, like, this is probably a 10-minute, you know, I mean, you have to get the data of how many property, that's probably the hardest part, is just to get the data of how many property management companies there are and like the historical growth rate or whatever, but we're talking like a couple hours worth of work. And that's as far as I would take it, because any, I would argue, like, then you start to hit seriously diminishing returns in terms of time invested and like what more accuracy and predicting like power you're really going to get. There's just some stuff that's frankly unknowable, and you just don't know how the market's going to evolve from here to there. So I, you know, that's the way I would think about it, is okay, like if we want to get to $100 million ARR, what would need to be true? And, you know, over what time frame? And if you're comfortable with that, like that's good enough. You can kind of put it to the side and focus on what really matters, which is, am I delivering real value? Am I solving a top of mind problem? And, you know, one step in front of the other, because to get to 100 million, you need to get to 10 million, to get to 10 million, you need to get to 1 million, to get to 1 million, you need a couple customers, right? So that's really what matters.
Yeah. And just like I said, there is so important to actually focus on getting customers, which I think sometimes people forget, right? They've, like you said, they focus so much on the data points of having a nice deck or having the storytelling. But from your perspective, if you haven't got paying customers, how do you know that somebody's willing to pay for it? And you mentioned earlier about the fake research. You might have 25 companies or 25 potential clients who might be interested, but there's that might. Will they actually pay for it is the huge difference, right? And that's what the traction shows and why that's so important. But obviously people like to say like, oh, but I should be able to get funding without that. It's like, well, how as an investor do you know that they're going to be able to fulfill that? So somebody's in the market, they're starting to make the progress there. What steps are left?
So step four, the second last step, is what I call like forget growth, find value. And the idea is that, and it's tied to this kind of over-strategizing that you see in decks around market sizing and go to market. You also see, you know, let's call it like over-forecasting, right? So, I mean, for me, just for what it's worth, like you get forecasts, you know, anything beyond, frankly, if you're doing like, you know, 10, 20, 30K MRR, your forecast, even in next quarter, is absolutely meaningless to me, right? Even if you're doing like $500,000 to $1 million ARR, you know, at most, like the next 12 months have some sort of meaning. Anything beyond that is complete noise. But the point is that in the early days, pre-product market fit, you actually don't know how to grow. You don't. Like, you don't know, like, if you think about a big company, right? Shopify, whatever, pick your best, doesn't matter. They know what engines drive growth. They know that if they spend this much on sales, this much on marketing, this much on product, it tends to turn to growth. And so growth becomes something that makes total sense for a post-product market fit company to focus on. How do we grow 3x this year? Okay, you back into that. This is what we need to do, blah, blah, cool. When you're pre-product market fit, you do not know how to grow. You do not have engines yet that lead to growth. And so focusing on growth, MRR growth, ARR growth, whatever, is a fool's errand. Instead, what you have to do is find value. And so the example I give here is the founder of Clio, which is a legal tech unicorn out of Vancouver. And when he started, he did a beta, which, you know, many founders do betas. But what he did different, you know, most founders are told you want to dramatically reduce friction in your product. Right? Like, you want the least amount of friction humanly possible so that it's easy to onboard customers, so that conversion rates improve and these sort of things. That makes sense if you want growth. But what Jack did is he actually increased friction. He forced companies that wanted to be part of his beta to jump through hoops. And what that helped him do is make sure that the people in his beta program, the companies in his beta program, were fully invested. And he there got the back and forth that he needed to make sure that he found and delivered true value. Right? And so that's kind of what the mindset flip, right? Is when you forget growth and you seek to just find value, you'll do things that don't make much sense in a post-product market fit world, but make complete sense in a pre-product market fit world, where all you are after is, again, making sure that you are finding ways to deliver true value to your customers, and not kind of putting the cart before the horse, right? You're not ready to methodically drive and predict growth. And so there's just no point doing it.
Yeah, it's like what you came back to as well when you said earlier about the person who gave people his phone number before for every customer. Because like you said, you can grow to a certain level through paid and just chucking money at a problem. But sooner or later, if your customers aren't happy because you're not delivering the value for them, everything is going to fall apart, right? And that's what it's trying not to be, I guess, get the shiny objects of like, let's see how much revenue you can get. Because you might get revenue fast and then
that can dip down very quickly. And I think some people forget that the charts don't always go up and to the right.
Correct. And it's also like, it's just the law of small numbers in the sense that if you have 100K of MRR and you go to 120K versus 140K versus 105K, that means something, right? There's a difference. Okay, wow, this company's growing 5% per month. That company's growing 30% per month. There's probably some going on. But if you have 1,000 in MRR and you grow 5% versus 30%, it's $300. Like, it's $250. So there's not much signal in that. There's way more signal in the qualitative aspect of, if I call your customers and I start asking them how important your product is and I get a sense of it, that's the signal, right? And that's really about value, not growth.
Yeah, it's always very funny to see people talking about when they grow like 200% month on month. And it's like, where it went from $50 to $200 or something like that. So, well, that's, you're still not actually breaking even or making any money really, or having many customers. And we're now coming up to the final step, right? So what's step number five?
So step five, I argue, is the most important and hardest one to get right. And what I'll tell you is that, you know, I've spoken with hundreds and hundreds of founders. Many of them have had to pivot. And I've yet to meet a single founder ever who said to me, wow, Pablo, I really regret doing that pivot. Like, just never happens, right? I've had many founders who say, I wish I pivoted sooner, right? They regret not pivoting sooner, but not the opposite. And so step five is pivot harder, faster, right? It's to constantly be, and this goes back to what I said, what's the number one mistake, is that you're not solving a number one or number two problem because maybe you didn't do the right research, because maybe you did, but you landed on something that, you know, there's a million different reasons. But at the end of the day, you always wanted to be tuned in. And I'll give you a personal example, right? So when I was at GymTrack, we started off with one business. At one point, we, you know, for tech reasons that didn't work, so we pivoted to something else. And this, the second opportunity, the second thing that we went after, the idea was, if you think about big gym clubs, right? Like big gym chains, like Anytime Fitness or Retro Fitness or whatever, every single piece of equipment in that gym costs $10,000 to $20,000. And if you have hundreds of clubs, that means there's probably $1 to $2 to $3 million of equipment in each club. If you have hundreds of them, that's a lot of money. And if you ask them, you know, why did you pick this brand of treadmill versus that brand? Why did you buy 15 treadmills and not 10? Like, these decisions are made fully blind. It's just a purchasing officer who just happened to decide that day, well, I'm going to spend $100,000 on these five pieces of equipment. That's how it's done. So we thought, okay, well, what if we put these little sensors on every piece of equipment? We can understand when they're used, not used, and we can create these dashboards that help gym operators optimize their equipment spend. And at first glance, it makes sense. And we went out and we went to trade shows and we spoke with a lot of gym operators and kind of showed them our product and got what you would expect. Wow, this is super innovative. This is awesome. Like, I would love to, you know, kind of move forward on this. And then as we tried to close these customers, it just, you know, we kept getting like, hey, yeah, come back next quarter. It's really interesting, but come back next quarter. We're just too busy with opening up a new club. Come back next year because, you know, you don't fit into the budget this year. Like, all these sort of signals that make you feel like maybe you're not solving a top of mind problem. For me, the biggest, the story I like to tell is there was one time where we finally landed a pilot. We're talking about $5,000 a year, okay? And finally we land a pilot and we're installing the sensors and I'm talking to their equipment officer. And it was so hard for us to get this one pilot, right? 5K a year. And he says to me, we're just talking. He's taking us through his gym, showing us the different pieces of equipment. And he's like, yeah, actually, so over here, like, I just bought, you know, five machines of this type, three machines of that type. And so we're going to switch this up. I'm like, oh, cool. How much is that? He's like, $80,000. And when'd you do that? Oh, just this morning. I'm like, okay, so you just spent 80K on machines like that. Just like, that's just another day for you. And I'm like, I've been months trying to get 5K out of you. Well, that's just like, you couldn't be more in your head, in your face. Like, you are not solving a top priority problem for this customer. But frankly, we made the mistake that we did not pivot at that time. Like, in hindsight, it's kind of like a no-brainer. But that's the biggest piece. And I have seen other examples I could go through of ones that have pivoted and have gone then through all the steps, done the right research, find real problems, gone in the market, and ultimately, you know, found true market pull, true market demand as a result. But that's the fifth step, is if you're not solving a top of mind priority, pivot harder, faster. You will almost always regret not having done it sooner. And look, in startup land, if you ain't first, you're last. So, like, if you're not solving a top of mind problem, in all likelihood, you will not get to where you want to get.
So you mentioned that you didn't make that pivot at that point. Can you let the audience know what pivots did you make later on down the line?
We didn't. I mean, the bottom line, like, you know, GymTrack ended up not working out, because what happened was, you know, we just kind of kept and it's, and this is the shades of gray, right? If you put out a product, nobody buys it, you're going to abandon it. You put out a product and it just takes off. That's awesome. Most of the challenge comes when you're in the middle. So with us, like, we actually had a few dozen customers. We had these sensors in market. We had some revenue, but we were not solving a top of mind problem. And so we didn't have the pull that we truly needed, but we had just enough to convince ourselves, to delude ourselves, frankly, that there was something there. And then if you just keep doing that for too long, at some point, your cash kind of keeps coming down. Your revenue is going up, but not fast enough. You can't raise around. And you get stuck between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, we tried to exit, but we got close and just not close enough. Kind of doesn't really matter if you hit the rim, it's got to go in, right? So at the end of the day, it didn't work out. You know, what would have happened if we pivoted? I can't tell you, but I just can tell you that we would have had more at-bats. That's really all you could ask for, is like as many at-bats as possible until you solve a true kind of hair on fire problem, or however you want to call it.
Yeah. And that's really interesting to see there as well, because obviously the best way to learn is from mistakes. And it's, if you did pivot at that point where you knew that they spent 80K and they'd been asking for 5K and they weren't ignoring you at that stage, you never really know what would have happened. And it's interesting to see now where sometimes people, one of the theories I love is where you should fall in love with the problem, not the solution. Because I think people who fail to pivot, they've fallen in love with what their solution is. They're doing the right thing that's going to solve this problem. But it, like I said, often it might not actually be the solution that people want. But if you can keep pivoting, you can find the solution that's going to solve the problem that you've identified in a way that people actually want. And that's something, one of the things I've learned, is just people who fall in love with a solution often will die when the market changes, when things, because you always have to adapt. Even if you find product market fit at one point, you might later have to adapt again as the market shifts or a new competitor comes in. And if you're in love with a solution, you're screwed.
It's the difference between persistence and stubbornness. Like, you do want to be persistent, because somebody who gives up too easily, changes too quickly, you know, well, it's never going to be that black and white. It's never going to be that easy, but you don't want to be stubborn. I mean, you also can't ignore the market realities and the signals that you're seeing, because, you know, you're just sure that this is the thing that's going to work. You know, I think people make that mistake about Steve Jobs all the time. Steve Jobs was stubborn. I don't know that he was stubborn. He was certainly persistent. He was persuasive, but at the end of the day, he figured out what people wanted and he gave it to them. Right. and that's not being stubborn.
Absolutely. So, we're going to wrap up soon. Is there any final points you want to make that people who are looking to prime product market fit right now should be thinking about?
Well, I'll give you this last one, which is, I think, is a good segue, you know, because these five steps, you can think of them. So you go through them, you know, before startup mode, this research mode, only insanely focused survive. You have to be in the market to win the market, forget growth, find value, and then pivot harder, faster. And I don't want anybody to mistake that it's a recipe. I mean, this is more art than science. And so the reality and the unfortunate reality is, if I give you a recipe to cook a steak, you should get a great steak at the end. If you follow these five steps perfectly, I wish you could just get product market fit, but it's just not that simple. But I will leave you with one story, with one final thought. I have a very good friend of mine, founder friend of mine, who I like to call a founder cockroach, because this guy can't be killed. He can't be killed. And his story is fascinating in its own right. I mean, he started his first startup in 2010. That startup failed. I met him in 2013 when he started his second startup. He started that with a co-founder of his, and a couple years in, they just couldn't get aligned. So he left his own startup. So that's the second failure. He meets somebody else. He doesn't, you know, he wants to stay in the startup game. And so he meets somebody else. And they're doing kind of, he's a technical founder doing something in ad tech. This guy, his friend of mine, knows frankly nothing about ad tech, but for whatever reason, it resonates and he joins them. And then from 2015 to 2018, they put out product after product after product, and none of them work. They all fail for technical reasons. So at this point, my friend has been in the startup game for 8 years and he has absolutely nothing to show for it. Like, truly nothing to show for it. Maxed out credit cards. He's still eating like ramen every day, right? Like, this is the life. And he still has to come up and show up to investor pitch after investor pitch to raise like 10K, 25K just to keep the lights on. But at one point he's kind of, you know, hit the end of the road. Like, he's got like 4 weeks of runway and he finally puts out, what would be like the third version and frankly, final version of this product. And he hits it huge. And I was getting kind of these monthly, updates. And it was just like 10K, then the next $1,000 in revenue, then the next month was 10, then 20, then 40, then 100, right? So 0 to 100K in monthly revenue in 5 months. He then grew from a million to 10 million ARR, and he sold his business last year for close to $100 million. Basically a bootstrap business. So he did like extremely well. But my point with that is that, you know, the reality is for anybody listening, there is no guarantee that you'll find product market fit with your current product. And if you look at my friend, he abandoned many products, right? There's no guarantee you're even going to find product market fit with your current startup. And you look at my friend, he gave up on many startups. I'm not saying don't give up. But what I am saying is there actually is a guaranteed way of finding product market fit at some time. But the only way is if you stay in the game. That's really the fundamental truth, is that if you want to make sure that one day you'll see product market fit, what you have to do is be willing to keep playing, keep getting at bats, and just stay in the game. That's what my friend Marty did. And it worked out. You know, maybe it could have worked out in many more years. You don't know when it's going to hit, but that's the only guarantee you got, because otherwise, you know, the odds of success are the odds of success. And even if you do everything perfectly, those odds are never going to get to 100.
So thank you so much for this episode. It's been really insightful, and I hope it's helped the audience a lot. If people want to learn more about you, your story, where should they go to?
So check out our podcast, The Product Market Fit Show. That's probably the best way to learn more about us and what we're doing. Obviously, you can check us out. We're a Mistral seed stage firm, investing across verticals. So you can check out mistral.vc as well.